to most Forest Hills in the borough of Queens, New York, is the site of the West Side Tennis Club, a once restricted institution that still hosts annually the United States Lawn Tennis Championships. But to many Jews in the New York area, Forest Hills has represented over the last two generations secure and pleasant apartment and brownstone home, not too far from work in Manhattan, in their offices. They contented themselves, they didn't have to spend hours on the railroads coming in from exurbia. And they were satisfied with the ambience and the security of their homes. The people of Forest Hills were middle class and well educated, and they have voted for the more liberal between two candidates in every major election in the last two generations. It was surprising, therefore, to see this largely Jewish community organizing itself, protesting, and demonstrating during these last months against a plan proposed by the Public Housing Department of Mayor Lindsay's administration, which would have built in its area a very large scatter house public housing complex, which the area felt it could not, did not want. Those who commented and analyzed this response, and there were many, discussed the issues involved, the concerns with the levels of middle class living, poverty, the questions of public safety, the questions of the impact of a large population on a public school systems. But in each and every case, they took this issue as another evidence that the close ties which have existed in American life for the last 50 years or so between the Jewish community and liberal causes and liberal philosophies was breaking up, was being pulled apart. Now, if Forest Hills had been only one possible evidence of this breakup, it might have passed unanalyzed. But there were many other indices which seemed to point to the fact that the Jewish community was moving away from its traditional liberal posture, its predictable liberal posture, and was adopting the posture which was more defensive and more conservative. Item. It seemed to be indicated by the levels of support in the membership rolls of civil rights organizations, particularly black civil rights organizations, that Jews in some numbers were limiting or withdrawing their support. Item. The traditional Jewish organizational position has been that there must be a high wall of separation between church and state, particularly in the area of public aid to parochial education. But increasingly, as the Jewish day school movement has developed, any number of Jewish organizations have, to use the idiomatic term, waffled on this traditional position, have begun to speak of the possibilities of certain kinds of legitimate public aid to the parochial and private school systems. Item. There has developed in the Jewish press for the first time a critical attitude towards most public issues, which asks, in addition to, does it seem to be a valid contribution to the reform of the American political system? Is it good for the Jews? Commentary, the subsidized magazine of the American Jewish Committee, which has always prided itself on avoiding particularistic Jewish stances, has more and more opened its pages to those who are willing to analyze critically the impact of various kinds of governmental programs upon the Jewish community. Dual affirmative action programs, for instance, which require certain percentages of minority groups be hired at all levels of employment. Do these have a particular impact upon the Jewish community, and if so, are they to be treated as acceptable? And there has even emerged a conservative Jewish press, designedly so. Item. All of us have noted in the last few years the emergence of the Jewish Defense League, which speaks in traditionally lower middle class chauvinist terms, which is conservative in the sense that it does not want changes in its neighborhoods, in its areas. And beyond the paranoia of the Jewish Defense League, we have seen growing a more moderate, mellow voiced, but more prestigious in terms of membership group, such as Jews concerned with the safety of our communities. Item. The polls indicate that when Jews are asked about their attitudes towards the complex issue of busing, their responses do not markedly differ from those of a cross-section of white America. Having taken all of these various straws in the wind into consideration, any number of people believe that there has been a visible, pronounced shift in the attitudes by Jews, by the Jewish community, towards any number of public issues which can be measured on a continuum from conservative to liberal. And I'd like to discuss this issue this morning. It's obviously very complex, and I can't begin to deal with all of its possible ramifications. But I'd like at least to air it and to open it up and to suggest to you what it means, what these indices mean to me as a rabbi in terms of the future of our Jewish community. Obviously, the first question we must ask deals with the whole premise of this discussion. Was the Jewish community ever predictably liberal? Or is it a figment of our imaginations? Have we taken the word spoken from 1,000 pulpits to be the reality spoken in 1,000 or 10,000 polling places? Has the Jewish community in fact been more liberal than its socioeconomic counterparts in the larger world? And the answer that historians give us here is an unqualified yes. Yes, over the last 150 years, in Europe and in the United States, since emancipation, Jews have been involved in liberal and radical causes and crusades far beyond their numbers in the general population. The first evidence which we can draw comes from the liberal revolutions of 1848, which sought to undo the repressive, archaic, ancien regime decisions of the Council of Vienna of 1815 after the fall of Napoleon. Europe, beginning in France and then particularly in Germany, had a year or two where great hopes were expressed for political reform, for a more open democratic system of government. Nationalism and political reform, the enlarged franchise, were running hand in hand. And if we analyze the composition of the Frankfurt Parliament of 1848, the liberal parliament elected at the very beginning of this revolution, we find that its president, Eduard Simson, was a converted Jew. One of its vice presidents, Gabriel Rieser, was a Jew who was a leader of the reform movement in Germany. That the Jews the number of Jews in the parliament was five times the percentage, in terms of percentage, of the number of Jews in the German states. Wherever one looked in Europe in 1848, one found prominent Jewish names involved in this liberal crusade. And many of those who founded this congregation in the 1850s were those who left Europe because of the failure of this liberal hope, who found it no longer congenial, and who brought their great hopes of political liberalism, of a broader suffrage, of a truly democratic society, an open society, to the new world, where they felt it could truly be established. And the 1840s indicated also that Jews would be involved not only in liberal reformist groups, but in the more radical groups demanding a more radical reconstruction of society. We begin to see the names of Ferdinand LaSalle emerge, the founder of the German socialist movement. We begin to see here the name of Karl Marx, of Moses Hess. Lenin at the Second International, after 50 years, remarked that as he looked around the International, one out of every three people there seemed to be a Jew. The Jews have been involved with liberal causes throughout the last 150 years. And what was true in Europe was true to a larger degree here in America. Our Jewish community voted for Bryan and Teddy Roosevelt and Wilson and Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Truman and Kennedy in overwhelming proportions. And they did so when they were polled and asked why, because they said that these men, in the context of their time, represented the kind of social and economic philosophy, the liberal philosophy that they espoused. And when in more recent years, statistics has become a more refined subject, and so has polling, when men went out and began to ask questions about political attitudes and to put them against one's place in the socioeconomic scale, in the Jewish community, it was found, unusually, that whether one was high in the scale or low, it tended to make very little difference as to which party and which candidate one voted for in the national election. Over the last 40 years, between 75 and 90% of the Jews in the United States have voted on the national election for the Democratic candidate. And if you want to see the degree of commitment to this socioeconomic and political philosophy, recognize the involvement of the Jew emotionally in the New Deal, in the personality of Franklin Roosevelt. So much so that even 25 years nearly after his death, Jews find it difficult to recognize that when it came to the question of European Jewish refugees, he spoke with a forked tongue. He spoke all of the words we wanted to hear, but performed none of the acts which the Jewish community in matters of life and death needed to have performed. And this blindness must be somehow related to our commitment, our involvement in the crusade which we could see all about us, the facts of change here in the United States which were so important to this community. Now, why is there this long history of Jewish liberalism? Is it because the Jewish tradition is by nature liberal, progressive, reformist? Yes, Judaism is traditionally a this worldly religion. It believes in justice. It believes in human dignity. We have the great prophetic tradition. But one must say this, that Jews in the last 150 years have made Judaism say what they wanted it to say. Instead of the law and order message of the Talmud, they went back to the more radical message of the prophets. And there was a theological reconstruction of Jewish life. We call it Reform Judaism. We tend to think of it in terms of minor ritual changes. But as a matter of fact, the basic change of liberal Judaism was to take the ancient messianism of biblical days and go back to it and forget the 2,000 years of more passive, more patient, more accepting, more conservative rabbinic Jewish life. And we use texts out of context, text out of their historical and theological moment to prove what we already believed, that our mandate was to be politically liberal, concerned, involved, sympathetic, empathetic, committed to the cause of human freedom and equal opportunity and human decency. Now the cynic will say, and the realist, that Jews have been involved with the cause of political liberalism because it served Jewish interests, for no better reason than that. Before the emancipation, we were the outsiders. We were the poor. We were the powerless. We were the impotent. The conservative groups, the groups of privilege, the groups of wealth, the groups who had the limited franchise, were all these the groups who were building the walls high to keep us out. We were the unwashed, and we were the unwanted, and we were those who were being discriminated against. And we joined each and every cause which tried to break down the wall, to let us in, to give us our share of the pie, our share of political power, our share of the ice cream and cake which an emerging, abundant society of technologically competent people was beginning to develop in Western Europe and in America. And of course, if one goes beyond that moment to this, the cynic, the realist might say that if Jews are now beginning to shift away from political positions, it is that now they are of the establishment, now they are of the privileged, now the walls of discrimination serve to preserve their narrow selfish interests. Because if others are to be let in, there will be less for those who have more than they deserve. Now there is obviously truth, far more truth than most Jews would want to admit to this particular position, especially in the last 10 years. So a number of polls have indicated that in the smaller cities in the Midwest, as Jews have moved up in the echelons of business and of their professions, they have become exactly as conservative, as narrow-minded as their professions and as their businesses and their professional bodies tend to be. And in town after town, in where there are rich suburban areas and where there are highly conservative professional and business societies, one finds the Jews who belong in these groups adopting the coloration, the attitudes, and as far as we know from the votes, voting exactly as their non-Jewish privileged compatriots do. But I suspect this isn't the whole answer, however true, however sad it be. There are other questions which must be asked. Has the Jew left the liberal position, or has the liberal position left the Jew? One of the problems which comes when we look carefully at a number of these instances with which I began this lecture is that they give off a slight stench of anti-Semitism. In New York City, 11 scatter housing sites were proposed. Three of these were in highly impacted Jewish areas. Eight of these were not. When protests developed against all of the scatter housing sites, this administration jargon is a mouthful, eight were dropped. Three were retained. All three that were retained were in highly impacted Jewish areas. Someone apparently made the decision that the Jewish community would not or could not effectively protest in the same way that other communities could. And because in New York City is in a sense a forerunner, a bellwether of what the nation will be, some of these affirmative action programs have gotten further in New York than elsewhere. And it has been to an exceptional degree, the Jewish social worker who has had to move over and then been moved out of various poverty organizations. It has been the Jewish teacher who's had to, and superintendent who's had to move over and move out of school systems which have been given over to local control. In New York State's legislature in Albany today, there is a bill which has no other purpose than to prohibit the public welfare agencies, the so-called organizations of poverty, from holding poverty board elections on the Sabbath. A program, a policy, which has developed in New York City over the last 3 or 4 years, which can have only one other one real purpose, and that is to deny the opportunity for the more traditional Jew, who tends to be the poorer Jew, and there are tens of thousands of such Jews in the New York area, from coming out and voting for a person who will actively and aggressively represent them, their minority, on the various poverty boards. But I suspect that when all of these caveats have been spoken, and when all of the many, many ramifications which can be raised about these issues have been raised, that the real issue of any change which has taken place in the Jewish community's attitudes, to the degree that it has taken place, goes back to a spiritual problem which besets our community, which is really an exhaustion of faith, tiredness. We suffer from tired blood. Judaism is a messianic faith. If you go back into the Middle Ages and you read its liturgy, you read its writings, you read what the people read, you recognize that the most important thing in their lives was the Mashiach, the Messiah, the day when the Messiah would come and would redeem them from the poverty, the misery, the impotence in which they found themselves. Messianism, the hope, lies at the very heart of the Jewish tradition. I believe in perfect faith in the coming of the Messiah. And even though he's delayed, achakelo, I await him. Three times a day in his prayer, the Jew uttered again and again the hope, next year in Jerusalem, may the Messiah come and redeem us. Will we come and revive the dead? Will he come and save us from the persecutions and the oppressions which we find all about us? Judaism is a messianic faith. And when in the 19th century it became now a possibility that we worked out this messianism ourselves in this world, we no longer had to wait for some magical, mystical coming, the Jews plunged into this opportunity with incredible psychic need. Jews rushed out into the larger world to find there everything that 100 generations of dreams and prayers had invested in that world. There was just the need to belong, to do, to build. And so we rushed out politically and we joined the reformist movements. We rushed out in terms of business, in terms of culture, in terms of opportunity. You found Jews moving into every area of European life like firecrackers, just exploding all over the place, urgently needing to find their, in a very real sense, the hopes which the prayers expressed. And we gave up our traditional messianism for a kind of secular messianism, a kind of secular hope. We would find in the brave new world which was building all about us the freedom, the opportunity, the fulfillment, the security which we so desperately needed. And Jews went out and fertilized and cross-fertilized every area of European and American life. We were not only overrepresented in political liberalism, we were overrepresented in the arts. We were overrepresented in medicine. We were overrepresented in education. We were overrepresented in all the new businesses. We were overrepresented in scholarship, in academe. Why? Because we could taste this new world. We knew of what it was made. Our dream was not of some second coming. Our dream was of a messianic age, and that messianic age was here and now. But there was a counterpoint, a sober, somber counterpoint to the last century and a half. It began with the Hep Hep riots in Berlin in the 1815s. It went on through the Dreyfus trial and the pogroms and the growth of a racial anti-Semitic literature. It went on to, it was to be seen both on the right and the left in Europe. When the Jew saw it privately in the jobs he could not occupy, in the quotas at his universities, in the clubs he could not belong to, in the places where he could not own or purchase or rent a home. In addition to the hope of the last century and a half, there was an increasingly visible denial of belonging, of brotherhood, of companionship, of acceptance to the Jew. And all of this climaxed in the 1930s and 40s, in Hitler, in Stalin, in the Ku Klux Klan, in Father Coughlin, in Gerald L. K. Smith. Wherever we turned, in all of our habitations, we saw signs of ugliness, Jew not wanted, Jew get out, Jew you are different. Then we had one in three of our people gassed and destroyed as the proof text of that we were not wanted. We threw ourselves into the hope, and to a large degree we were repelled. There was 45, and we were aghast, and we were sobered. We had a new word in our vocabulary, Holocaust, the burning of the 6 million. But close after, we had 1948, a new state. And somehow most of us satisfied our need to have some proof that this was the brave new world in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. This was the proof that there was reason still to hope. We carried on the hope. Israel went to building. And life was fairly good and peaceful and comfortable here in America. But then there came 1967, which in a very real sense, I think, represents one of the major watersheds in the history of the Jewish spirit. Jerusalem became ours. The hope was dramatically fulfilled, and at the same time, we recognized that we had very little. Soviet anti-Semitism burst on the scene. One began to feel all kinds of anti-Semitic rumblings here in the United States. And Israel could not find peace. The Jew as victim could be tolerated and accepted. The Jew as victor was on his own again. No one would make peace. Do you remember the Khartoum conference right after 1967, after the war? No discussions, no negotiations, no peace. The Jew found himself 150 years after the beginning of the emancipation, unemancipated. He was exactly back where he had been 150 years ago, unwanted, on his own, but he had lost something in the intervening period. He had lost the spirit which nourished his soul. He had lost faith in the Messiah, and he had lived for the most part a thoroughly secular life. Wherever you go in these United States or in Europe, or to enter a very large degree in Israel, the synagogues are empty. The Jewish libraries are unattended. The Jew has tried to satisfy himself in work, in doing, and in building the brave new world, and he is not worried about replenishing himself, the moments of quiet, the moments when he contemplates himself and his God and his position in the world, the moments where he draws renewed strength from confronting an age-old heroism and a great and heroic truth. We Jews have lost the wellsprings of hope to a very large degree. And if there is a new conservatism in our attitudes, I doubt that it's to do with terribly sophisticated political analysis. I suspect that it's due largely to a failure of nerve, an exhaustion of faith. For once, I hear Jews saying, for once let somebody do something for me. I've gone out and I've served for every cause that came down the pike. And I've given of myself and more, and I've asked nothing in return. But once in a lifetime, is that too much to ask? Where are they? Must I always be Don Quixote, you know, jousting with somebody else's windmill? Why doesn't anybody show up to join hands with me in my source, in my need? And because we've lacked somehow, most of us, most Jews, we have lacked a patience. We have lacked the steadying of faith. We have not nurtured the world within. We have tended to be broken by this new recognition, the post-67 recognition, that our condition has changed a great deal, but has really changed very little. That we are not fully accepted, that we walk away, which is to a large degree alone. The Midrash tells us that when a man approaches the gates of heaven, He's asked only one question. He's not asked, were you a good soul? He's not asked to show his bank account or even his level of charitable contributions. He's asked only one question. Hatzipita lishua. Did you have the guts to hold out for God's promise of salvation? Did you have hope? Or did you despair? There are times when our people have despaired. And I think we're moving into one of those times. Now, there were times when our people despaired and had reason to despair. There was nothing that could be done to benefit their condition. But our time is not such a time. There's every reason to believe that the world outside of us is not irredeemable. There are decent people and good causes and effective work being done, and work of which we should be a part. And there are those men of goodwill who have joined with us and fought battles for us and fight battles with us today. Our world has a great deal of opportunity and of possibility implicit in it. Somehow, deep within, we're going to have to find again the faith, the courage to have faith, the moments of quiet, of contemplation, of turning within, which nurture faith. And if we do, I think we can touch again the wellsprings of hope from which a liberal political posture can be taken. Not liberal in a doctrinaire sense, for I agree with those who say that any number of liberal causes, or those labeled liberal today, are no longer liberal. They tend to override the rights of the individual. They tend to be contemptuous of due process. But at the same time, if at this moment in time the Jew were to turn turtle, and to draw in his arms and his legs, and become concerned only with his cause, let him be concerned with his cause. But if he were to be concerned only with his cause, he will be untrue to the possibility implicit in the situation. Therefore, he will be destructive of the very survival of his community of which he claims to be so interested. For our survival depends upon the survival in decency and opportunity and expansive possibility of the larger world. Now, as a rabbi, I have no five-year plans, and I have no very practical suggestions to make. I sometimes wonder what people think when I talk always of the needs of faith and the meaning of faith. But I suspect that this crisis, this mood of crisis, which I sense in our community, or rather a mood of despair, a gray mood, a shadowed mood, could be dispelled. For it corresponds less to actual reality than it corresponds to an emptiness within. And if we can take our communal institutions, our synagogues, our libraries, our schools, and turn them into vital places, which means places we come to, we will find that our community can nourish again the hope, the expectation, the promise, which will make it possible for us to be sensitive and vigorous and to care. How will you answer the Archangel Michael on the day when he asks you, Hatzipita Lishua, did you really hope in God's salvation? Amen.